His scowl and withering remarks were things to be feared in Lord Sugar's boardroom. Now Nick Currier appears as a slightly friendlier face as he puts the nation to the test on Channel 4's Countdown. But in both programmes, he's shown an ability to deal with big figures. But he's worried some others are being caught out by financial scams. And he's with me this morning. Morning, Nick.
Morning, Chris.
We'll talk about the financial scams in just a second. But everybody will be sitting listening to that music. And a lot of people will have sat in front of the TV last night and watched The Apprentice. Do you actually still watch it?
Oh, I do. I've got it stacked up. I didn't see it last night because I was busy travelling to London from Manchester, having done 3 days on Countdown. So I'll have to catch up on that later on this evening. But great programme, great series, strong, big characters, and yeah.
You say a great programme, but there are times I sit and I watch it and I think to myself, they must go out of their way to make these people look stupid. I mean, you have been there and you have watched these people for real.
Yeah.
I mean, do they go out of their way to make it look bad?
I think the producers audition. They need people with courage, self-importance, big characters, because it's a real hothouse in that program, and they've got to be able to withstand the heat. Now, let's be frank about this. Some of them are not necessarily the most brilliant people in the whole world, but what that program does is to show its huge audience the basic principles of business, because in every task, there are the planks of a business proposition, and that's the value that The Apprentice gives to young people in the country, young people in the audience, right? Now, if everybody was absolutely brilliant, you wouldn't get those huge audiences, because everybody watching has got to be able to say, I could do better than them. And that is the key to the success of that programme.
Yeah, but do you not think that it also needs to perhaps show more flashes of brilliance? It does need some brilliant minds on there, particularly if you're going to push the economy forward. And on this morning here in Northern Ireland, we're looking at job losses. There's a real concern about, you know, the private enterprise, about trying to increase the manufacturing sector, for example. Mm. All things which you and Lord Sugar particularly feel is deeply important.
Sure.
But actually, sometimes it feels like it's a competition that might be a bit more of a joke and a bit less of a lesson.
It's sort of, you know, some people might accept that is, in fact, the reality of it. I would argue, as I've just said, each task is a fantastic little business proposition, and the way that it's handled will educate those watching. Secondly, the winners who go on with a £250,000 investment with Lord Sugar, they're all doing incredibly well. They're all making money, and that is the validation of the programme. Those who come through and win are smart and good people.
Yeah, and a lot of that, though, is down to the business plan, isn't it? And you would imagine then he has an inkling, perhaps, of what he wants and who he wants, even at the start of the competition.
Oh, I'm not sure that he gets deeply involved in that, really, right at the start. They have to earn their spurs as they go through. And all I can say, really, is the people who have won are terrific. But I'm really going to cling on to my argument, and I'll wrestle to the ground anybody who says it's a worthless programme, because I think it educates young people. And now there are apprentice programmes running in pretty much every school you can name, and companies have got their apprentice competitions. It's done a lot to demystify business, just as the Dragon's Den has as well. Sort of just showing that business needn't be complicated, but it needs focus, it needs enterprise, creativity, products, all of those things, the ability to present, all of those things go into making a good businessman. And my word, those sort of qualities are examined under a microscope by Lord Sugar, that's for sure. You wouldn't want to be sitting the other side of the table to him, I can tell you, Chris.
How important do you think those kind of entrepreneurial spirits and abilities are? Whenever we are facing Brexit, when Brexit is coming, do you think the UK's economy is going to be tested?
Oh, I'm sure it is. Listen, I'm not an economist, but for one thing I can tell you is that the entrepreneurship, the spirit of entrepreneurship, is vitally important. You know, people think I mean, it comes in two planks, really. If you're perhaps your company's having a hard time, you're made redundant with all those years of experience and all the rest of it, then that's the time then to start your own business, perhaps with some colleagues. Or if you're a young chap who is fanatical about motorbikes, then come on, follow your passion and open a little motorcycle repair shop or whatever it is. Don't wake up thinking that you can suddenly start an aircraft building company, to, you know, thinking about Northern Ireland at the moment. Do something that you know a lot about and you have a passion in.
I suppose part of the reason I'm asking you that question is because obviously there's a lot of talk about what happens to the border, the impact on industry here, particularly with agriculture. And you were involved in a programme for BBC Northern Ireland.
I was.
You know, looking with farmers, trying to diversify their business. Are you worried about the impact on agriculture in this part of the UK particularly?
Well, you're a lot closer to it than I am, to be quite honest with you. I'm terribly worried about Brexit, full stop. I'm a Remainer, and I cried myself to sleep, you know, when the referendum came through with a Brexit vote, because I think it could be a disaster, I'm afraid. A disaster. And there we are. We've got to make the most of it, but we don't seem to be doing a very good job at the moment. The border in Northern Ireland, I mean, I don't know how that's going to function, frankly. I just don't get it. Excuse me. It's a horrible rumble in the background for me, and I don't like the sound of it.
You are a supporter of the Labour Party. Do you think that they would be the answer in all of this? Because I'm not sure you're necessarily that big a fan of Jeremy Corbyn.
That's true. I've always voted Labour. I'm not a fan of Jeremy Corbyn. I got it completely wrong because I went on Question Time with a shadow minister and said, I'm sorry, but he's unelectable. He's not a leader. You know when you meet a leader, you know when you look in their eyes or shake their hands. Did I get it wrong? Because Jeremy Corbyn ran a brilliant campaign. He captured the heart and soul of the young people, perhaps with some pretty dodgy promises on university fees and so forth. But I got it magnificently wrong, as indeed did the Tory party. So I'm slightly adrift, to be honest with you, Chris, at the moment, politically. I'm a little bit homeless. I'm a bit homeless.
That's an amazing thing to say in itself, though, because I suppose you wouldn't be alone within the Labour Party. The Labour Party kind of grew significantly under Tony Blair, and a lot of people will criticise him in retrospect. But what he did was he brought different voices and different attitudes within the Labour Party.
Yeah.
If there is that floating contingent of people within that who are dissatisfied with Jeremy Corbyn, where do they go?
I don't know where they go. There's not going to be a breakaway. I don't suppose they're going to drift off to the Liberal Democrats.
Because I'm actually right in thinking, aren't I, that Lord Sugar, he actually quit Labour amid all of this, didn't he?
He did, yeah. Yeah. He's a crossbencher now. Do you know, I think the world is in such a pickle at the moment that I'm not going to be much good to you on this, Chris, I'm afraid, because I'm as confused as the next one.
Well, that's an honest thing to say, which is frank in all of this. When we talk about the world and where it's going, I suppose there are also people who kind of think to themselves, at least we have a little bit of the old securities there. And I do want to talk about Countdown, because so many of the people listening to this programme will watch Countdown. It's been an institution for years. You mentioned years back from Manchester filming.
Yeah.
What do you get out of that? There are times I see you on that programme, kind of, and you look to a little bit stern occasionally, kind of like a teacher sitting there. But do you really enjoy the programme?
The programme is, as you say, an institution. First programme on Channel 4 back in 82. It's in the Guinness Book of Records and all the rest of it. It's a great show. There are no big prizes. We don't get holidays or give away sets of saucepans or money or anything else. You get a teapot. And yet people queue up. We get audiences, you know, pouring in to watch Countdown, because it's a clever show, it's a difficult show, and actually, interestingly, just as an aside, the number of Irish people that come and play Countdown in Salford at Media City is extraordinary. This week we had one day when we had two Irish people playing against each other. One from Belfast and one from Limerick or somewhere, I think, from memory. So the Irish love it. Now, the value of it, it's clever, it's honest, it's an institution, I suppose, but there's nothing flash, but you know, flash in the pan about it. To be quite honest with you, Chris, I'm not terribly good at it.
Listen, I've been trying to do an anagram of your name all day and failing miserably at it. So that's okay. That's all right. But what I think must be fascinating for you is the contrast of characters, though. Yeah. You go to Countdown, which is this show full of quite occasionally intense people, but people who are very clever, who are there specifically for the intellectual challenge.
Yeah.
And you come from a programme which is full of people who are there for the money, there for the fame, and there to really be big, big characters.
Yes, I think they are quite well spotted there, opposite ends of the pole, because the Countdown people are, generally speaking, very modest, very ordinary people who love the show and are very good at it. We get people, you know, who can crack the conundrum in a second or less. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And we love them. We love the passion they display and the gentlemanly conduct too. They shake hands with each other. There's no shouting or screaming.
Yeah.
Neither will there ever be, thank you very much, because Countdown is a very decent, gentlemanly sort of affair.
From The Apprentice, are there any that stand out? Because obviously, you know, there are different parts of the UK that will remember people particularly. But I think from over here, we remember Jedi Jim particularly well. And we remember Leah Totten, who went on, I think, to win the show, didn't she? Yeah. So who stands out for you from The Apprentice candidates?
Over the years, I was always very fond of Syra Khan. Tim Campbell, the first winner, was a great, great chap. I liked Jedi Jim. He was extraordinary. Leah, there's a young guy from Derry, Londonderry, called McCulloch. He was in The Young Apprentice, and he was a brilliant young fellow. At the age of about sort of 15, he looked like a statesman. He's now working with Saatchi and Saatchi in London, doing very, very well. But there are all sorts. I mean, there have been over 100, of course, now that have gone through through that studio, and many have gone on to do great things. But I think I'm still in touch with a few of them. But Syra Khan is a great, great pal of mine.
Yeah, and those are people who are very financially astute. But actually, what I'm looking at from here, from this report that has been done by the Financial Conduct Authority, there are deep concerns about just the number of people who can be tricked into getting involved in fraudulent schemes. And actually, Belfast is one of the hotspots.
That's right. I think it's number three.
Yeah.
It's number three. See, the problem we got here, Chris, is that these clever people who have got the time and they'll pursue you, they'll hunt you down like an animal, really, over time in order to release from you your savings. And they target, in the main, over 55s who have crystallized their pensions. And when you're over 55 or 65 or 75, and I'm nearly there, of course you slow down a little bit, perhaps you're not as sharp as you used to be, and they will play on that. They will offer you not extravagant returns if you invest with them, but something reasonable like 8 or 9%, which of course is far more than you're getting from your investments at the moment, which are pretty much nothing. And they'll promise you this and they'll promise you that and they'll remember your wife's birthday and they'll send flowers and they'll lure you in. And the average take, according to the Financial Conduct Authority, and it's the Financial Conduct Authority I'm supporting at the moment with their Scam Smart campaign, the average take is £32,000. Now, that's a lot of money in Belfast, Birmingham or anywhere else. And what we're doing with the Scam Smart campaign is to try and raise awareness so that if people are approached, they immediately get onto the Financial Conduct Authority website and alert the Financial Conduct Authority to the fact that they've been approached and the name of the people or the company that has approached them. And that will be added to a list of something like 4,000 rotten companies that are on the Financial Conduct Authority website, because only then will people be able to judge whether the people approaching them are being scammed, you know?
Yeah.
And something like 22% of people approach, stay silent, don't tell anybody.
You see, I wonder as well, just at this particular time, whenever we talk about the real financial strains on people, that there's not much money around.
Exactly.
But those people who have some money and kind of feel that they want to try and make the best of it in this situation,
yeah.
I suppose it's an easy time for a fraudster to kind of come in when you aren't getting much money in the bank for your savings or whatever, to come in and say, listen, I've got a big deal for you.
That is exactly it. In the old days, of course, they made these extravagant, I'll double your money in 6 months and the rest of it. So they're clever because they just come in at the level that we used to get. I've got some money in one bank. They charge me for having it on deposit. So if somebody comes in and says, I'll give you 8%, I'll say, wow, that's interesting. Certainly. But as I say, 22% stay silent. Don't tell anybody, their family or anybody else. And in our survey, only 36% who were targeted got onto the Financial Conduct Authority. When you compare that 36% to something like 81% of people who report fly tipping to their local authority, or the 84% that get all furious and report to the supermarket that there's a spillage in aisle six, you know, we've got to get that 36% of people reporting to the Financial Conduct Authority up to the 80s and 90s. We've got a stamp on this. It's a huge scourge on the country. Unfortunately, at least, you know, Parliament is beginning to think some, you know, about it, because they're now moving a ban on cold calling. Well, that's fine if you can police it. But of course, it doesn't stop all those rotters down in Marbella in their boiler rooms, or in Thailand ringing you up with American accents trying to sell you dodgy shares or wine or overseas property and all the other things that they try. But the other thing, Chris, is we all think we can spot a fraudster. Let me tell you, many, many, many of us can't.
Do you think you could be taken in, given that you have watched all of this business in action? Because there are the human stories behind those statistics. But do you think you would be somebody who could be fooled?
I was approached a while ago now by some American banker from the Taschen Bank in New York. He used to ring me up every morning. And I sort of smelt a rat, because why he was ringing me, it was 10 o'clock in the morning in the office. What was he doing in the office at 5 o'clock in the morning in New York? So I sort of, you know, went along with it. And then I said, look, you know, go away. You're obviously a bad man. But, you know, I then told that story to the City of London police. They've got a unit working on closing down these boiler rooms. He said to me, you don't seriously think he was in New York, do you? Well, I said, well, he told me he was. Well, he said, of course he told you he was. He was probably in Brixton. He might have been in Belfast.
That's a dreadful thing to say about Belfast, a place which you actually have some family links to as well.
Let me give you one thing, Chris. Must give you this website so that you can get onto it and have a look at the 4,000 rotter companies and what to do if people try it on. And that's www.fca.org.uk/scamsmart. You'd be amazed. I met one chap. Can I tell you a very quick story?
Yeah, go for it.
He was scammed twice. And I said to him, he said, no, don't worry. He said, he was such a nice chap. He'll be back. I know he will. He was a really good guy. Yeah, I know he took quite a lot of money, but I trust him. I said, when did you last speak to this good guy, this friend of yours? He said, well, about 2 years ago, but he doesn't seem to answer his phone anymore. And I said, oh, please, you know.
I talked there briefly about your family links to Belfast. Yeah. Actually, your family used to hold authority in this town.
My grandpa was quite a character. He represented the Falls Road in the 20s, okay? He was a home ruler, which was a bit of a strange thing to be in the Falls Road, but he kept getting re-elected. He became an alderman, then he became High Sheriff of Belfast, the first Catholic to be a High Sheriff, actually, and then became Deputy Lord Lieutenant, and then became a commissioner on the Harbour Board. So he was, Ozzie Jemison was quite a character, actually. He's a lovely man.
Given that background, do you keep watch on politics here? Do you show any interest in it? Be honest. You're allowed to say no.
I'm too busy, to be honest with you. I'm too busy, and I love the North. I love Ireland, actually, and I've got an Irish passport, and but I can't claim to be really following it too deeply, no.
Yeah, but if you've got the Irish passport then as well, that does indicate that as somebody who is a Remainer, at least you can stay European as far as you're concerned.
Let me give you a hint. When I travel on the Irish passport. You get swept through every time with the British passport, which you probably got. You struggle a little bit sometimes.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, there's a lot of people talking about the changes here, and you know, we've seen this week actually even Lonely Planet has called Belfast and the Causeway Coast their number one place to visit in 2018, but actually. There are main problems here, as you know, with politics and everything else. But just before the news at 10 o'clock, we spoke to someone who lives beside a Syrian family, refugees, who basically have been attacked on a constant basis. Now, you actually did a documentary series along with Margaret Munford about immigration.
Yes.
In this Brexit world, do you think we are becoming a friendlier and more open place? Or do you think there is the danger that we could become a lot more closed?
Well, I pray that we do not. And let me tell you very quickly that we have a family member in hospital at the moment, very seriously ill, a very surprise situation. The staff are almost entirely East European, who were born outside this country, and they are magnificent. So to lose, or in any way to make immigrants like that unhappy, would be a very cruel and unjust thing. I'm a great fan of European immigration. And, you know, sometimes when we look at the Irish situation, it's rather rich, is it not, that when Ireland in the 1840s was in deep trouble, countries took the Irish in, notably the Americans, I guess. So now the Irish should perhaps, and I count myself as Irish, should recognise, you know, that there is a duty sometimes to help those who are in trouble.
Are you worried about just becoming more closed, though, in this world wherever it is talking about Brexit, about the, I suppose, even the time of austerity, whenever people are concerned about their money? Because openness is something that really, I suppose, is at the heart of a lot of communities.
Yes, I pray that we don't follow the sort of thinking that seems to be percolating in the United States at the moment. And I think we have there's a humanity at work, and there's also a practical consideration in the United Kingdom. You know, if all the Eastern European workers were told to go home, or indeed something like 25% of NHS staff were asked to return to their home countries, the place would fall apart, frankly.
You talk about America, and you mentioned somewhere earlier about the worried about the state of the world. Of course, the bizarre thing is that Donald Trump, as president, is the man who led the Celebrity Apprentice program in America. He is America's Alan Sugar in many ways, a businessman who became a reality TV star. It seems clear you're not as fond of him as you are of Lord Sugar.
I'm appalled by him. In fact, when he was elected, I rang up one of the producers of the American show, which brought Donald Trump to national prominence in the States, international prominence, I suppose. And I said to this chap, I said, if you ever step into this country, I'm arresting you on the grounds of, you know, a terrible crime. How dare you to have promoted this guy to this state whereby he's now actually the president of the United States? I think he's a shocker. And I've just read last night that wonderful speech from, was it the Tennessee Senator Flake?
This is Flake, yeah, Senator Flake.
That's one terrific speech. I mean, it really is a wonderful speech. You see, Trump's sort of style makes us all descend to his level. So we're using language about him that he uses. Are you with me?
Yeah, but
he's a shocker.
The weird thing is it's a mixture of celebrity and politicians, which you could argue Lord Sugar is as well.
Well, Alan Sugar's not a politician.
Well, he's in the Lords, which makes him part of the whole process.
In that sense, he's a legislator, but he's not out there banging the drum. He's a crossbencher and speaks very frequently in the Lords too.
Listen,
actually, on subjects about which he knows a great deal, like the media and telecommunications and electronics and all the rest of it.
It has been fascinating talking to you, Nick Cure. Thank you very much. Enjoy for joining us this morning.